This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Laurie Barth, a software engineer, educator, and speaker. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Laurie.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. So I'm Laurie. I am a software engineer for a company called 10 Mile Square in the DC metro area. I've been in the field for a little over a decade now, and I spend a fair amount of time speaking and blogging and teaching and kind of doing community work and outreach for the next generation and current generation of developers.
What do you like blogging on?
These days, I've been doing a lot of kind of JavaScript basic spec stuff. I have a couple posts in the next few days where I'm going to go into CSS pseudo classes and how you can use them to replace some JavaScript of old. And just kind of whatever I'm working on, I try and find bite-sized pieces that I think are generic enough to apply to a bunch of different people, kind of no matter what they're working on. And if nothing else, give them the ability to recognize a piece of syntax the next time they go into someone else's code base.
And then you make videos as well, you said?
Yeah, I do Egghead. I'm an Egghead instructor. So if you have interest in, you know, some of those JavaScript snippets, and I'm about to do some CSS videos as well, you can look me up and watch, you know, quick bite-sized, less than 2 minute syntax videos to figure out, you know, how to do what it is that you want to do, and hopefully follow along with what I'm doing and you're off to the races yourself.
What we're going to talk about primarily for tonight, though, is your speaking conferences. But before we get into maybe the nitty-gritty of it, why do you like speaking at conferences?
There's a lot of reasons. So I got into it kind of in 2017 because there was a local conference. It was a first-time conference. And they had the theme for the year was legacy code. And at that time, I had previously worked for the federal government, and I was currently working for a very large kind of telecoms company as a consultant. And I said, you know, I've seen nothing but legacy systems. I can talk about that. And I have a musical theater background and a kind of debate team background. And I like being on stage and I don't mind audiences or public speaking. So I figured it would be a good fit. And it's turned into so much more than that. I mean, I love speaking. I love crafting talks. I think there's something really interesting and dynamic about being able to tell a story with technology and kind of engage and entertain people. And I love the people I meet. I love the places that I go. There are incredible communities of developers all over the US, all over the world. And I have met just an amazing number of people with completely different experiences than I have had. They live in different areas, they work in different companies, they come from different backgrounds. And I love that. And it gives me an opportunity to kind of get out of the DC bubble and learn everyone else's story and see how much of what I do ends up translating and being very similar to what they do, even if we as people are very dissimilar.
You said you worked for the federal government for 10 years?
So I worked for the federal government for about 3 years when I was first starting out.
Oh, I'm sorry. But but is that where you came across all the legacy code?
Yes.
Okay, because that's what I was going to ask. So it was the government job that led you to the legacy code.
Yes.
And that was what you knew and understood, and that became your speaking topic. But how do you go from knowing about something to presenting on it?
Yeah, so if people want to see that talk is on YouTube. You can search Laurie Barth. It's called The Tablecloth Trick. The slides are something out of a middle school PowerPoint presentation. So don't judge me for that. I've learned since. For me, it was, when I worked for the federal government, I was part of a developmental program, which meant I went through rotations. So every 9 months or so, I would move to a different organization within the agency I was in and work on a different project. And what was unique about that experience was that it's the federal government. So I saw a lot of things that were wrong, and I figured what's funnier, especially in the DC area, than telling a story about legacy code replacement through failure. So the entire talk is all the ways we failed to do things right. And it got a fair number of laughs, which I was proud of. But in general, I knew that I had this really unique experience. I mean, people work on legacy code replacement for years, and it's the same system. And I had seen all of these different systems that had all had their own issues and been similar in some ways and starkly contrasting in other ways. And so I figured no one else could give this talk but me, and this talk would be interesting to people. And so it was less, how do you go from knowing about it to talking about it? And more, I knew there weren't that many other people who knew about it, and I thought it was a talk that people would appreciate.
How did you craft, though, that knowledge into a story that would interest other people? Because I know a lot of people that don't present. They say they'd like to, but they say, I've got nothing to present on.
Yeah, so everyone has a different process. And I would say trying to kind of design a process based on someone else's may or may not work for you. But I can tell people what I do. I get in my head something that I want to talk about. I joke all the time that I take the bus to and from work and I just stare out the window listening to music and like 20 talk ideas come to me. So that may not be everyone else's process, but I have an idea or a title and I say, this could be interesting to talk about. And then I write down literally on a physical piece of paper. It's funny because I have one in front of me. It's just a notepad and it's got a bunch of kind of buzzwords or stories or things that relate to that topic. And once I have them kind of all out in a jumble, I start making connections and I start circling things and I say, how would this organize in a way that makes sense? Should it be chronological? Should it be by topic? Should it be based on a story that weaves this set of stuff together and then this experience together? And no two talks are the same. They don't all follow the same narrative structure. But when I have all the stuff I want to say and all the things I want people to come away with written down in one place, it becomes a lot easier to craft a narrative that makes sense based on that information.
The first time you did it, it sounds like you did it as a kind of, this is my experience. It wasn't a heavily technical one. Do you think that process would work for, you know, I'm going to teach you about the CSS, the JavaScript that you blog about?
So technical topics are a little bit different than narrative stories. Technical topics should be narrative for sure, but you have to follow a little bit more prescriptive of an approach because you want to make sure that the introductory stuff is covered. So wherever you're starting your talk, kind of for some people, they're going to say you need to have these experiences and this knowledge to understand this talk. And they start at that level and go from there. And there's other people who will cover all of the introductions and basics and say, you have to come in with no knowledge at all. But wherever you start your talk, you need to follow some kind of order so that it's building on itself. When it's a technical topic, when it is a overall management topic or a more narrative approach, you can get a little more loosey-goosey there. So they are different. That doesn't mean that they don't have overlap. But for a technical topic, you do want to make sure that you're not jumping around too much because it becomes very challenging to follow.
Yeah, I completely agree. One of the talks that I have given was on how I learn from people. It was primarily about the podcast, but a big part of it was you have to have a start, a middle, and an end, tell a story, and have kind of a contextual path. Each question in my podcast, I try to make it build on the previous so that the person I'm talking to understands what they're being asked and the listener knows. And then the same way, I think with a presentation, to your point, you shouldn't jump around. What you're doing next should be related to what you did before and continue.
Absolutely. And one of the things, this is not mine. This is from a mentor of mine named Ted Neward. He says, you should be able to distill your talk into kind of a 1 to 2 sentence explanation of what problem you're addressing. And then you should make sure that by the end of that talk, you've addressed any problems that you've introduced. So if you say, hey, we're going to talk about this because of all of these terrible things, and then you get to the end and you've only introduced solutions to one of those terrible things, then your audience is like, wait, what? So it's important to make sure that you are presenting something that is solving some kind of issue for someone and they will find valuable and be able to use in their day to day. And that any issues that you bring up to kind of engage them and say, these are relatable and you understand them, that you also cover solutions and avenues for addressing those instead of just being like, here are all the problems. And now I'm not going to tell you how to fix them. And we're going to go on a kind of divergent path.
I've seen that. You're absolutely right. I guess the one thing could be, if you have a 2-sentence summary of a talk, you then somehow have to expand that into an hour as well.
Yeah. The 2-sentence summary is meant to be, can I explain what I'm trying to do? And if you can't do that in 2 sentences, then you probably haven't distilled what you want the talk to be about. They can be slightly run on 2 sentences, but if you don't have a very clear vision for what you're attempting to talk about, then you're going to get kind of lost in the forest, as it were, because you're going to diverge in too many different directions. Even if you have some tangents and some other stuff, as long as it's always coming back to that central point, you know that you have key takeaways and actionable information for people to use after they've sat there for 20 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, a 4-hour workshop, whatever it is that you're presenting on.
We've kind of been talking around this. Those are a lot of the elements that make up, let's say, what you consider a good talk. But are there other things that you would like to say?
Yeah. So I think good talks come in all shapes and sizes. The number one rule is that they're engaging, that people are interested in the topic and they find what's being explained to them valuable. I think there are kind of components of giving a good presentation, which might be different than a good talk. But other things that are kind of in the good talk realm is things that are widely applicable to everyone in the audience. So it's not some super specific thing that, like, you know, one person in the world is going to care about. It's a talk that people can take things away from. And I also like the idea that a good talk is somewhat personal and that the person who's giving it is clearly excited about it and interested in the topic and really kind of has that passion. There's nothing worse than someone who gets up on stage and says, my company paid me to be here to give, you know, some generic talk about their technology and I think it's terrible. And you can tell I think it's terrible. Like, nobody wants to sit through that. So talks that people are excited about. On the presentation side of things, there are kind of 3 things that I always tell people. So one, again, this is stolen from TED. If you are at a conference that's more than one track, one of the best things you can do for your attendees is right away say what you're going to cover and at what level you're going to cover it and give them an out and say, if that's not what you thought you came here to see, that's super fine. There's other talks going on during this time and I want to make sure you get value out of it. 99.9% of the time, no one's going to leave the room, but they also won't spend the entire talk sitting there waiting for you to get to the thing that you never planned on covering in the first place. The second thing is people can't read and listen at the same time, and you don't necessarily remember that. So keep the number of words on your slides to a minimum. Visuals are really great. 1 or 2 words, 1 sentence if you have to, but really it shouldn't be a bunch of kind of bullet points that make it challenging for the audience to look at. And the final thing is you probably talk faster or slower depending on your nerves. And so the best thing you can do for yourself is practice in front of a real audience. If that's coworkers, if that's friends, if that's family members, it's not the same as talking to yourself in a room. You would love it to be, but it's not. And it'll get some of the nerves out, but they might have some feedback. It helps you kind of get a better sense of what your timing is and all of that. I remember the very first talk I ever gave, I was terrified that I was going to just, it was like a 15-minute talk. And I was terrified it was going to be like 7 minutes long, and timing had me so, so nervous. So that's one of those things that can be challenging for newer people. And I recommend kind of doing that test trial run, as it were.
I was watching some training videos on giving talks. And one of the things that I had kind of discounted was that my audience needed to be entertained. Mm-hmm. And I was completely wrong. And I come out of that what I was training, I was watching, you know, you should treat it like a speech. You should change your intonation. You should pause. You should be dramatic. Mm-hmm. Just because your audience are a bunch of engineers who are there for the facts and want to learn something, that doesn't mean you shouldn't play to them. And I think a lot of people miss that.
Yeah. So a lot of that actually comes back to teaching philosophy. And I'm not a teaching philosophy expert, but adult learners are very different than child learners. And if you go through any kind of training courses or similar things, one of the things they will talk about is adult learners need a break roughly every 50 minutes to an hour, because you can't sustain their attention for that long. And part of that is because we move away from the let's give them engaging, exciting teaching topics for kids, and we move to dry, boring, lecture at them for an hour. And then they get bored, and adult learners need a break. They need a break either way, but we should not remove the engaging, exciting, interesting, multidimensional teaching and education styles that we use with children, because they are just as effective, if not more, for adults, since adults aren't sponges the way that kids are for information. They need to hear things a couple times for it to stick. I think the rule is technically they need to hear it 3 times for it to stick. They need to kind of have multiple methods of hearing the same information, whether it's video or audio or written or diagrammed or whatever. And it's always great to have either your slides or your example code or whatever it is available after. Because if you tell people that at the start of your talk, they get to focus on what you're saying and not worry so much about taking notes or taking pictures of your slides or worrying about the content on screen. They can get that later.
Let's say you've decided that you know something and you want to present on it. You have to find a conference that you, let's say, want to go to, and then you have to apply. What's the general process for applying?
So the general process for applying is every conference needs your name, a quick bio about you. They normally want a link to a headshot, and they want an abstract. Some conferences want an abstract and then a further breakdown that only the organizers see of kind of what you're going to talk about in some kind of time interval. And other conferences, and they do tend to specify this, is they want an abstract and a description, both of which are eventually public. So you want to pay attention to the specifications of what you're being asked for. Beyond that, some conferences are really specific about what they want to see in their abstracts and what they want to see from potential presenters. For example, CodeMash really doesn't like for you to use you or I or we, and they want everything to be kind of generic and not have any of those words in it. Other conferences don't care. I have an entire abstract that says I a bunch in it, and it's been accepted in a fair number of places. So pay attention to the specifications of the conference you're applying for. Beyond that, what you're looking for is roughly a paragraph, maybe 2 short paragraphs, that is a engaging, hooky summary of what you're going to be talking about. Now, the titles, some people like really fun titles, and some people like very clear, direct titles that tell you exactly what you're going to be covering. But pretty much always, the abstract needs to be exciting and inviting, because you're going to be looking at, you know, a conference breakdown, and you're going to look at the schedule, and you're going to say, do I want to go see this talk? Is this talk interesting to me? Is this the time I want to go talk to vendors? Is this the time that I want to go take a nap in my room? Is this the time I want to go explore the town that we're in? And so having an abstract that says, this is what I'm going to be talking about, this is why it's interesting, this is why you should care, is really critical. And I won't lie, it is a hard thing to do. I am not great at writing abstracts. There are a couple I have that I really like. There are a few I have that I feel meh about and I would want to change. Actually, for anyone who's interested, you can go to laurieontech.com or laurieontech.dev and go to my speaking page and scroll all the way to the bottom and you'll see every abstract I have. They're just out there for the public. But there are people I know in various JavaScript world who every time they write an abstract, I'm like, oh, I would go see that talk. That's so good. That's so interesting. And that's what you want. You want someone, even if they know the topic, to say, this is an interesting take, or I think this person would be really fascinating, and I'm definitely going to come away with one or two new things, even if it's a topic I already know.
What do you think makes a good abstract?
So it's got to be clear. Some people try and get kind of fancy with their language, and I'd say kind of go the like fourth grade reading level route. It doesn't have to be that level, but go with the idea that you want it to be as accessible as possible. And kind of hooky, right? I read the first paragraph of an article in the magazine. Am I going to keep reading? That's really what you're looking at. This is kind of your first opening pitch to come sit in your hour talk or however long your talk is. This should be the start of it. This should be, we're going to talk about this, and this is what you're going to take away from it, and this is why it's going to be interesting. And if you can distill that into that paragraph or two, that's normally a really good abstract.
I think another thing that I meant to mention earlier, it relates to abstracts, though, is you kind of have to know your target audience. Some conferences are for very high level, and there's no point going along with something that's been known for 2 or 3 years. But some conferences are more local, and they're kind of like a large code camp. And those kind of conferences, you could go along with Entity Framework in Web API, and it would be a winning abstract, a winning presentation. And that would not work, though, at a big ticket one.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Knowing your audience is important, but also don't sell yourself short. Let the conference decide whether or not it's a fit for their audience. As long as you've described it well, they should make a good decision. Don't say, you know, this talk definitely won't work. Granted, if you're applying to a JavaScript conference with a C++ talk, yeah, maybe don't send that in. But if you're applying to, ngconf and you want to talk about something that's been in the Angular ecosystem for a couple of years, but you think you have a unique take on it with some really good use cases, or maybe it's not an often used technology and people kind of overlook it, don't discount yourself. There's a talk that I give that's been really popular this year called A Software Engineer's Guide to DevOps. And what people like about it is it's not geared at people who do DevOps. It's geared at people who are software engineers like me who just need this introductory lay of the land. And it's shown up at a couple of DevOps Days conferences just because there are people who go there to learn about DevOps, as well as there are people there who are DevOps practitioners and experts.
Let's say you have a good abstract, you've got a good talk. Should you start small, you know, present it at a local meetup, move on to a code camp before you try to get onto, let's say, the stage at Build or Ignite or the big other technology conferences?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be a meetup. It can be, you know, a small local conference. But I think starting at least your very first time out with something a little bit local, maybe a little bit smaller, that can be really beneficial, because I thought I was going to get on stage. It wasn't really a stage, but in front of a podium for the first time, and I was going to knock it out of the park compared to all these other, you know, geeky tech people, because I have a theater background and I'm a performer and all of that. And I did fine. I mean, again, it's on video. But I was way more nervous than I expected to be. I was really kind of shaking in my boots. And you don't know that's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. And so trying things out for the first time, I'd also say that's true of your talk content. If you've got jokes in there, or if you have content that you think you're going to breeze through and it turns out that the audience isn't hanging on with you as much as you wanted them to and you need to go slower through sections, having all of those kind of things worked out, at least your first time out, is really beneficial in a smaller environment. People are going to give you feedback. It's going to be a little bit low stress. When you're standing on a bigger stage with the lights and you've got audiences of hundreds, you don't get that kind of individual conversation to the same extent. You don't get that. You can't see the audience as well and see how they're reacting and slow your pace or speed it up. And so you'll get that even if you introduce a new talk at something like an Ignite. But your first ever, I definitely think start somewhat small, whatever small means to you. I still haven't been to, I don't know what people would consider a major conference. I've done a lot of really great large community conferences, like a Kansas City Developer Conference. I'm going to be at Connect Tech. I do have a conference in Munich that I'm going to be at, all of these kind of great gigs, but I have not spoken at ngConf. I have not spoken at kind of Chain React or any of those things.
What specific things would you say a new speaker should know, or what would be of great benefit to a new speaker that they won't find out for some time?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that you can get help with that they don't necessarily advertise. So there are a lot of conferences that will give you feedback on your abstract while you're still in the process of submitting it, while the CFP is still open. Ask. And even if they won't specifically, there's plenty of people on Twitter and in Slack groups who will give you that feedback. And you can normally edit most abstracts. You can edit while the CFP window is still open. If you get a rejection, and rejection probably isn't the right term, it's a non-acceptance because there's so many spots. But you can sometimes ask for feedback in that situation as well from the organizers and say, hey, was there something I could have done differently? There's actually one of my very first conferences, KCDC, that I was accepted to. They gave me feedback and they said, please reapply next year. And I said, I definitely will. And it was that interaction that they had a couple cancellations and they ended up inviting me that year. So those positive interactions and showing that you're really interested makes a difference. You can ask if they don't, so if they don't cover travel or hotel, you can always ask if they have any funds available and see if they might be able to support you. And one of the best things you can do when you're first breaking in is to have video. So if that's you recording yourself giving a talk to a meetup just directly from your laptop, that's great. If you end up having more professional video at some point, that's obviously amazing too. But there's ways to give people evidence that you are a good engaging speaker and that they should take a chance on you and kind of invite someone new into the fold.
The whole thing of costs has become a bit of a topic, I think, in conferences, hasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely has. And it's and part of the reason for that is kind of twofold. One is it makes it harder for underrepresented groups to break in because they might not work for a giant company that is supporting their speaking and their travel. And it kind of has it makes the gulf wider between those who have the opportunity to do so and those who haven't. And two is there's a lot of people who it's done wonderful things for their careers, myself included. And so having that gulf of opportunity becomes even more of a detriment because it has such positive impacts on people's kind of public persona and expertise and opportunity to meet others and be involved in the community. So it's a really great thing to be able to do. And it's important that we make it as much of a level playing field for everyone and not just people who might have the out-of-pocket money to do that.
What general tips would you give to someone presenting, let's say, on the day? Things like, you know, include your Twitter or a hashtag or something on slides.
Yeah, so definitely include your Twitter on every slide. There's kind of two reasons for this. One, if someone decides to take a picture of your slides, you always have your name associated with it, and it's clear that it belongs to you. And two, if someone is going through your talk and wants to tweet about it, they don't have to remember what your Twitter account was from the very beginning of your presentation. Some people do it kind of going along the side. I do it on the bottom right-hand or left-hand corner, kind of whatever works for you. Other things that I would recommend is your font and your diagrams need to be a lot bigger than you think they do. Some of these rooms are very large. Some of these projectors are not as big as you would hope for them to be. I was in a room that had a divider that had been open. And so it was like three classrooms long, and I had just a regular old projection screen. It was basically the size of a map in a school classroom. And there was nothing I could have done to make my font big enough for that screen, make my diagrams big enough for that screen. And people said that at the end. They said, you know, I couldn't see in the back. So make it as big as you possibly can. Some of that's obviously on the conference organizers to make sure that things can be seen, but you'd be surprised how big these things need to be. The other thing is color contrast. You don't know if you're going to be in a dark room or a bright room or any number of other things. I used to think that, you know, cool colors was really fun. The best slides to read are white background with some dark-ish font. Whatever that is. It's easier to read uppercase and lowercase than it is to read all caps, even though all caps looks cool. And just in general, kind of keep in mind that things are going to show up differently on a projector. So don't add a bunch of little tiny details. Don't have a really complicated background. Make it easy for people to see the content that you're trying to display. Those would kind of be my main tips. Oh, and for if we're talking about like day of prep, if you need to kind of – I do not go to a talk before my own talk. I don't want to have someone else's content and topic in my head. Plus, it means I can stalk the outside of the room I'm going to be going into and get in as soon as the next speaker is done, so I can check my AV and make sure everything's good. Sometimes you'll have a mic, sometimes you won't. So learn how to project, but also recognize that you need to be wearing clothes where you can hook a mic. I have worn dresses and I have pockets in them. That is necessary. And do your best to, it's not wander, but if you're standing behind a podium, that's fine. Make sure you're tall enough for the podium. I often am not. I'm a short human. But if you're going to wander, try not to draw people's distraction too much, but it can also be a little bit engaging. And you don't want to be totally stuck at your computer because you've written really extensive notes that you need to read off of. People know if you're reading a script, and it's to your advantage to be able – you don't have to memorize word for word what you're going to say. If you have a general idea of what topics you're going to cover for each slide, you can do that. And you should do that. And it's going to come off feeling a lot more natural than it would.
Yeah, I'm going to add a few. You did mention it. I always test out the equipment ahead of time. So I tried to go in a day before, hook up my laptop, and it worked to my advantage. This year at a conference, we realized that my slides were not within the projector's full range. So things were missing off the sides, which was no good. I wasn't going to change my slides. So the audiovisual people had a look and they sorted it out. They had an incorrect setting. They were at the wrong resolution. So then I went in the next morning and I tried it again and it was perfect. So, you know, that they had a night to figure it out. Another thing I do is I tend to have two laptops with me, both ready to run. They both have my PowerPoint. They both have my demo code and they're both sitting there. And I use one, doesn't really matter. And then another thing that I found very handy is I have a Logitech Spotlight presentation remote, which is, for people who don't know, it's a simulated laser dot that you can put onto your screen. So if you're in a room with two or three screens or maybe more, it's not much point having a real laser to point up at a big screen because you're pointing it on one monitor and not others, and it's also not going to be on a recording. So that's a very handy tool. It's not cheap, but it's not super expensive either.
Yeah. So I have a, I don't have the Spotlight. It's very nice. It's a very snazzy tool. I have another clicker, but I would say having a clicker is really nice because again, you don't have to hover by your laptop. And I do not go as far as having two laptops, mostly because I do not own two laptops. But it's absolutely true that you always want to have a backup. So make sure that your presentation is in some kind of duplicated state. If that's Dropbox or Google Drive or an external drive or whatever it is, you don't want your laptop to die the day of your presentation and the only copy of it was on that computer, because that has happened to people and that would not be an ideal situation. So just make sure that you have a duplicate, whatever that looks like for you. The reason I say that instead of the double laptop situation and the Spotlight is there are a lot of people who want to get started presenting who don't have the funds and resources to have those kinds of things. Don't let that deter you.
No, no, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's great to know that when you get to a point that you do have the resources, there are things you can do to make yourself really slick and redundant and awesome. And the Spotlight is amazing. And one of these days I'm going to buy it for myself. But, I think my investment this year, I got the clicker. I'm trying to think, what else did I get? I feel like I've been getting the mic and some other stuff for the more video, audio visual stuff, which isn't necessarily in person, but.
Part of the reason I've got the two laptops is I generally, the presentations I've been giving have been on resiliency and robustness. So it would be very embarrassing if I got on stage and my laptop stopped working and I didn't have an immediate backup.
Teaching stories by failure, I'm telling you, it's effective.
I'm happy to do it, but not on the day. So that's all. This is all very good, let's say, for people who are beginning. What advice would you give for those of us who want to improve our speaking?
Yeah, I mean, I want to improve my speaking. I think we all want to improve our speaking and kind of get to the next level. The thing I found super beneficial is to have other speakers in my talks, to have conversations about my upcoming abstracts and talks that I'm crafting with other presenters. They always have really great insights. They have good ideas for how you should break down the story you're trying to tell. They have great feedback where they said, okay, this section was really good and I really liked this slide, but this section you moved through too quickly and you lost me and you seemed to lose some of the other audience. That kind of feedback is really beneficial. I would also say kind of get a few talks that you're really comfortable with, kind of core talks that you've given. They say you get sick of it. You don't know a talk until you've given it five times and then you're sick of it and you want to change it. And getting a couple of talks that you're really confident in that you can play with and you can say, okay, I can do the same slide deck in 45 minutes and I can do it in an hour depending on what I know I'm aiming for. When you get to that point and you get to play around with the same material again and again and again, you're honing your speaking and you're honing your presentation skills instead of the content of that particular deck and that particular talk. And then you get to get a little more interesting and funky and kind of test your boundaries and see what you like and what you don't like and what works for you. I think one of the things that's important is not everyone is the same type of speaker. So there are speakers who are really great because they're hilarious. There are speakers who are really great because they are the most expert person in the room on any given topic. And there are speakers that are really great because they're sobering and they'll scare you and you'll sit there and come out and say, oh my goodness, I need to do this right now to fix this problem. So kind of learn what kind of speaker you are, and you don't need to be the same kind of speaker for every talk that you give. Find the type of talk and the topic that works for you in the kind of presentation mode that you want to be in.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
Follow me on Twitter. You can see all of my blogs and speaking and videos on my site. And if you have any questions, feel free to kind of send me a message. I love talking to people. This is a topic that I really enjoy.
So. Remind us of the .com, the dev, and the Twitter, please.
Yeah. So it's all Laurie on Tech. So it's at Laurie on Tech. It's laurieontech.com. It's laurieontech.dev. And those are the same site. They just, I felt like getting the .dev URL recently because Twitter's a bad influence.
Well, Laurie Barth, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you liked this episode, you might also like episode 94 with Todd Gardner about building your brand, or episode 90 with Shesti Sandberg and Charlotte Ling about the Norwegian Developer Conference, or episode 80 with Angela Duggan about imposter syndrome. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Focus by A.A. Alton from the album Connections.